as the subject allotted to me is, what is preaching? Let me say that I'm conscious of a very real sense of privilege in being asked to come here and to take some part in this conference on this all-important subject. I'm afraid that I've been practicing or trying to do so much of what I've got now to speak about that I find myself somewhat weary and tired, so I trust that you'll bear with me. But quite apart from that, I have always found it extremely difficult to speak on this particular subject because it's one of these matters which I personally, at any rate, find it quite impossible to tabulate in my mind and to get into any order. I've been struggling with this question for the last 40 years, and I don't think I'm any nearer to the solution than I was at the beginning, perhaps far much further away, probably. Why is this? Well, to me, preaching is a great mystery. It's one of the most mysterious things of all. And that is why I find it eludes any kind of analysis. I don't know what your experience is, but personally, I find that I never know what's going to happen when I enter a pulpit. I'm constantly being surprised, sometimes surprised in the sense of being disappointed, at other times surprised at the amazing grace of God. Sometimes I go into a pulpit, I think I'm going to preach in a wonderful way, and it's disastrous. Another time I go with inadequate preparation because I've been traveling and doing too much and really feel that I have no right to be in a pulpit at all. And I find unusual ease and facility and am aware of power. That's my difficulty. There is this mysterious element in preaching that makes it well nigh impossible for one to speak about it. And then there is a second element which always makes me feel that this is an impossible task. And that is the element of dread, the element of terrible responsibility. Now, I do want to emphasize this just a little, because to me it's one of the most important things of all in connection with this subject. What I mean by that is this, that there is surely nothing which is more serious, nothing which gives one such a tremendous sense of responsibility as preaching. But I think you'll agree that this aspect of the question is very largely forgotten or not realized at this present time. I don't know what your situation in this country is, but the position as regards preaching in Great Britain, and especially in England, has become quite chaotic. And very largely because this element I'm now dealing with, this element of dread and of responsibility, has somehow gone out. People seem to think that preaching is not only something simple and easy, but something which anyone is entitled to do. And one can do it at will, almost. And so we've got this chaotic condition. We've got men who've been recently converted, and the next thing I hear about them is that they've been preaching somewhere. Now, I think I can trace the origin of this. I think the brethren, Plymouth brethren, are mainly responsible for this deterioration in a true view and a true sense of responsibility with respect to preaching. They, all of them, seem to be preachers, and I've often felt that the text that one should preach on, if one were addressing a congregation of Plymouth brethren and nobody else, the text one should take is the first verse in the third chapter of the Epistle of James, "Be not many masters, my brethren." Because they all immediately become masters. And that kind of influence seems to have percolated through the various sections of the Christian Church in Great Britain. It's all, I think, a part of the deterioration in the view, the true view, of the Christian Church and the functioning of the Church. owing, of course, to the disastrous higher criticism and the liberal and modernistic elements that came in, there was such a shortage of true believers, true evangelical believers, that there was a corresponding shortage of true evangelical preachers. And thus, any man who was evangelical was regarded almost automatically as being one who was competent to preach. But I think this has been a very great fallacy, and it's done very great harm, particularly because it has made people forget this tremendous sense of awe and of responsibility, which should always animate us as we engage in this great task of preaching. Now, there are many ways in which I can illustrate this. Take the question that the Apostle puts in Romans 10. You're familiar with that passage where he deals with this whole question of the propagation of the gospel. Whosoever shall call on the name of the Lord shall be saved. How then shall they call on him in whom they have not believed? And how shall they believe in him of whom they have not heard? And how shall they hear without a preacher? Then, and how shall they preach except they be sent? Now, I was tempted to just expound that one statement to you, but I'm not going to do that. But I do commend it to you for careful study. How shall they preach except they be sent? Who sends them? With us, I say, the trouble is that people are sending themselves. They appoint themselves as preachers. Surely, this is entirely wrong. I interpret this statement in Romans 10 as meaning that God sends us, but also the church sends us. And no man has a right just to get up and start preaching, or what he may regard as preaching. There is this element of sending. And we must return to this, and it'll help us to get hold of this notion of responsibility. You've got to be sent. You've got to be sure that God's sending you. You've got to be sure that the church is sending you. Now, I'm well aware that someone may well get up and say, but what about so-and-so, certain great exceptions in history? Well, my answer is that they are exceptions. And the exception proves the rule. You don't make a rule out of your exception. And that's what's happening today, at any rate, as far as our country is concerned. There have been times when a man has been so sure of his calling from God that he's defied the authorities. And there are times when we've got to do that. But a man who does that has got to be very sure indeed that God has called him. The ideal and the right way is that the call comes to the men from God and it is confirmed by the church. And I take leave to doubt whether any man has a right to preach, except these two elements are present in his particular case. But then still more important and more serious is what we find the great apostle saying in 1 Corinthians 2, verses 3 and following. I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling. And my speech and my preaching was not with enticing words of men's wisdom and so on, but I'm particularly interested in that third verse. I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling. Now, I want to ask some questions. What do we know about this trembling? What do we know about this fear? Why did he feel that? Look at this man, this colossus of a man, this outstanding genius. He was in fear and weakness and much trembling. I wonder whether a man has a right to be in a pulpit at all and to even attempt preaching unless he knows something about this fear and about this trembling. Here's the greatest preacher of all. Yes, that's how he felt. Why? Well, the responsibility. He's standing between God and men. He's dealing with the souls of men and their eternal destiny. He's a guardian, a custodian, a steward of the mysteries. There's nothing in the universe that is comparable to this. The responsibility is almost overwhelming. And yet I think you'll agree with me that there's very little evidence of this at the present time. As I say, it's almost become the rule now that men rush into pulpits and appoint themselves as preachers, and there's nothing in it. They do it so easily. I've often said that as I have seen it and understood these things during the years, that there is only one thing that is more dangerous than being a preacher, and that is being a lay preacher. And that is, of course, for this reason, that there are terrible temptations to the preacher, but there are certain things that tend to keep him in order. He is supported by the congregation. That's a good thing. Yes, and a good thing in more than one way, a good thing in this way, that it tends to put a little bit of a break upon him. But you see, the lay preacher enters the pulpit and he's independent. He can say what he likes, he can speak what he likes. He's in no danger of being dismissed or asked to leave. He's in no danger of having his stipend reduced. And that's what makes his position alarmingly dangerous. But you see, most lay preachers, they never realize this. They are perhaps of all men the most confident. And that is where I say the most dangerous thing that can ever happen to a man is that he should be a lay preacher. Isn't it amazing that people can thus enter into pulpits with confidence and ease and assurance, no trouble at all? They can do it as an aside. They can be running a business or in a profession, and as an aside, they can do this thing which to these miserable preachers seems to be so difficult. Nothing in it at all. Well, now, there's only one thing to say about that. They are the extreme antithesis of what we find to be true about the great apostle himself. But I can give you further examples out of history to substantiate what I'm saying. Those of you who are familiar with the life and the journals of the great George Whitefield, one of the greatest preachers of all times, will remember his hesitation about preaching. He was alarmed by it. He was frightened at this tremendous thing, and he went through considerable agony of mind and of spirit. He felt he was unworthy. And surely a man who doesn't know something about this sense of unworthiness has no right to enter a pulpit at all. You have this mighty preacher. He's the type of man who hesitates long and seriously and has to be forced. I could give you another. There was a man in Wales 200 years ago called Howell Harris. He was a layman. He was never ordained. He was one of these exceptions to whom I've been referring. And yet, this man, again, who was so mightily used of God, he was terrified at this thought of preaching. In fact, what he did was something like this. Having had a great experience of the Spirit of God coming upon him in an overwhelming fashion, he felt that he had a duty to his neighbors. But he thought the best way of discharging this duty was to visit them and to read to them out of godly books. He started visiting the sick. And he would read a book called The Practice of Piety, which had been published in the 17th century. Now, it never occurred to him that he had a right to speak. In fact, he felt sure that he hadn't. But he could read out of this book. But he read out of the book with such unction that people were converted while he was reading this book. And then he went on doing this until he'd finished reading all the books that he'd got. And still he felt he must tell people about their souls and salvation. So he now felt that he'd got to say something of his own to them. But still, this idea that he should be preaching was so alarming and so terrifying to him that what he did was this. He still had a book in front of him and appeared to be reading out of the book when he was actually speaking his own thoughts. So, all right, you evidently query the ethics of that procedure, but whatever you may think about it, I'm using it to show you the sense of dread, the sense of fear, the sense of awe. Now this to me is a very vital and essential part of preaching. And it is because of these elements that I find it so difficult, indeed well nigh impossible, to deal with this subject. If only we could transport ourselves back some 220 years and go down into Philadelphia and listen to George Whitefield, then we might learn something about preaching. We'd see a master preaching. And then, having listened to Whitefield, if we were fortunate enough, we might listen to Samuel Davis also. You people have neglected Samuel Davis. Let me put in a word for him. The greatest preacher you've ever produced in this country was Samuel Davis, the author of the hymn, Great God of Wonders, All Thy Ways Are Godlike, Matchless, and Divine, the man who followed Jonathan Edwards as president of Princeton. You can get his sermons. Here was another obvious master preacher. And at that time, we might have listen to him likewise, just a little bit later, perhaps. But these men, they were here together at the same time, and if we could only sit and listen to them, we might know something about preaching. You'll forgive, perhaps, just a personal word in passing. I say I've been wrestling with this subject for 40 years and more, and I've had two experiences which I shall never forget. I have a feeling that I've only really preached twice in my life, and on both occasions I was dreaming. And I still remember the awful feeling of disappointment on both occasions when I found I was only dreaming. If only I could preach like that in the pulpit when I'm awake, then I think I could claim that I have preached. But alas, that is the position. Well now, the best I can do, therefore, to try and help in this matter is to talk round my subject. I can't analyze it. I'm incapable. Let me start like this, therefore. Preaching, I think we'll all agree, has been neglected, sadly, especially during this century. There's been a decline in preaching. I know that that is true of your country as well as of our country. You know, if you'd visited London 100 years ago, and indeed until the beginning of the First World War, the problem you would have had in London would be which of the great preachers to go and listen to. There were many of them. And the problem was which of them to select. But by today, the position is entirely different. There's no problem at all. Is there any preacher that you want to go and listen to? And it's worth your while to go and listen to. And it's the same in your country. There is a dearth of preachers. Why? Well, because it seems to me the whole notion of preaching, somehow or another, has fallen into the background, and people no longer believe in preaching as they once did. What's the cause of this? Well, I can analyze it, I think, fairly accurately as regards Great Britain, and I believe it may be partly true here. In Britain, I'm sure one of the major factors has been this. We had a prime minister in Britain whose name was Stanley Baldwin. He was a man who came into office in 1924. Now, he followed certain men of the type of Lloyd George. Lloyd George had been prime minister during the war and had in his cabinet people like Winston Churchill and Lord Birkenhead and people like that. Now, all these men were great speakers. They were great orators. And Stanley Baldwin wasn't. And he was a very clever politician. And he realized that the only thing a man like himself could do was to say something like this. Now, I'm not a great man. I'm not a great orator. I'm just the ordinary, plain, simple Englishman. He was giving the suggestion that oratory is dangerous, and that if a man's a good speaker, you can't trust him. The only man you can trust is the quiet, homely man. He can't deliver a great oration, but he can give you a little friendly chat. But you can trust him. Now, that idea has undoubtedly come into the whole realm of this question of preaching. I've watched the development of this thing, a distrust of preaching. You had a man here in this country, I think he did great harm. Some of you older people will remember his books, S.D. Gordon. And the titles of his books, to me, gave the whole case away, and it's done great harm to preaching. The title of all his books was Quiet Talks on So-and-so, Quiet Talks on Prayer, Quiet Talks on Power. It must always be a quiet talk, just a little friendly chat. None of this great pulpit oratory. That's dangerous. That's not spiritual. Quiet talks, just a little conversation. Well, that's it. Now, these factors, you see, have all worked together. Then, of course, this terrible invention, the radio and the television. They've been a great curse. And they've been a great curse for many, many reasons. One is, of course, that generally you're on a time limit with these things. And that's destructive of true preaching, always, as I'm going to show you later on. But apart from that, you see, there is the impersonal element that comes in. Very often the preacher is alone in a room, which is very bad. He's not in contact with his congregation. And then these various techniques that they talk so much about. There have been several courses of television technique which men have attended. I can't imagine anything so pathetic as that preachers should allow themselves to be instructed by these little television experts and others as to how to conduct themselves, even putting on that ridiculous smile that, and all the rest of it. Now, all this, of course, is destructive of the whole concept and idea of preaching. I'm here to speak the truth to you, and I must criticize things I've observed amongst you as elsewhere. I don't understand this idea of a preacher going into a pulpit on a Sunday morning and looking at the people and saying good morning to them. That's the world. That's the world. He shouldn't do that. They come there to listen to the word of God, and he comes from God. There's no need for that kind of thing. And already I feel it disturbs with this essential thing. Well, there is that factor. Well, then another factor, of course, is the reading. And as people have become better educated and have gone in more and more for reading, the whole notion of preaching has tended to be depreciated. The intelligent man feels that he doesn't want to be harangued by a man standing in a pulpit. He can do his reading at home. He can read the same books as the preacher. Why should he therefore listen to the preacher? It's more intellectual to sit down and read a book for yourself. I think that has done very great harm indeed. Their idea has been that our forefathers, they didn't read, they hadn't got the books, and they couldn't read very often, so they had to depend upon this one man who seemed to be an authority. But they've rebelled against all this, and reading has come in instead of preaching. Well, each one of these points, of course, could be taken up, and one could show the tremendous difference between reading even good books and preaching. There's no comparison. Preaching is God's ordained method and way, and reading can never be a substitute for preaching. There is something peculiar about preaching, which reading can never attain unto. Another factor that has done great harm in our country, and I believe also in yours, to the whole question of preaching has been a bad and a false kind of popular preaching. We had a glut of this, especially in my own country of Wales. Men, you know, who turned preaching into entertainment. Men who were much more interested in the way in which they said things than in what they said. And men who were experts at what is my pet abomination, namely the use of illustrations and stories. The whole point of a sermon was to get an affecting illustration. They knew it would have its effect upon the people. So the whole notion of the sermon and of preaching became one of this kind of entertainment. So you had a false kind of popular preaching at which any truly spiritual person, indeed any intelligent person, almost became disgusted. If there's a term, again, I abominate it, is the term pulpiteer. You know, you had those great pulpiteers, the Henry Ward Beechers and people like that. They did infinite harm to preaching. These great masters of assemblies, these bombastic men who reigned, as you know, in the mid-Victorian and the late Victorian era. These men, I think, did very great harm to the whole concept and notion of true preaching. And then, just to add another to this list, the whole sacramentarian movement has had its influence. Again, in different parts of the church, of course. This has been very true of the Anglican church, in all countries of the world where they are. But it's permeated into the free churches very largely. The idea that the sacrament is the central service of the church, and that this is more important than anything else. Now, the history of this in the Anglican Church in England is really very fascinating. The Anglo-Catholic movement began in the 1830s, and more they went in for vestments, and they went in for new ideas with regard to the sacrament, approximating more and more to Rome, and as this developed, preaching correspondingly went down. So the sermon became a mere triviality. The great thing was the administration of the sacrament. And then the very last that I put into this category where we're dealing with the things that have done such harm to preaching has been the whole notion of personal work, which I believe you call counseling. And this again has militated against preaching. You know, the idea has been that what is really needed is this personal conversation. People can put their questions and their difficulties, and you just work it out together. Look, preaching has perhaps some kind of a function, just as a general introduction to get people to come and talk to you. But the real vital thing is going to be done when you're having a private conversation with them. This is one of the main results of the interest in psychology and the coming in of the psychological element into pastoral work and indeed into the whole activity and the life of the church. And as this emphasis on the personal work has increased, correspondingly, the emphasis on preaching has gone down. I could illustrate this again in the case of Wales, where, of course, we always believed in preaching more than they ever did in England. They believed in preaching more in Scotland and in Wales than they did in England. But it's gone right out in both countries, and very largely because of this personal work emphasis. And in Wales, it was almost entirely due to one professor. He was later principal of one of the colleges of the Welsh Presbyterian Church. He couldn't preach himself, poor fellow, and he was supposed to be a great psychologist, but never realized his own complex, which was clear to some of us. He resolved his own personal problem by discounting preaching and emphasizing the value of counseling and of personal work. And he was such an able and affable man that he influenced two or three generations of young preachers who didn't believe any longer in preaching as such. And of course they were able to contrast it with this, what they were doing with this false kind of popular preaching. And the result is that the whole notion of preaching has become depreciated. Well, now there are some of the factors that have militated against the true understanding of preaching and the place of preaching in the life of the church. Well, now, what then is preaching? Let's try and get a little bit nearer to a definition. Again, I can only do it by giving you some negatives. What is the difference, for instance, between preaching and what I was saying just now, namely reading books? What's the essential difference between these two things? Why do we say that people should come to the church and that preaching should go on in the church, rather than that they should read these books at home? What's our real reason for saying that? What is this peculiar thing, if you like? What is the differentia of preaching that marks it off from all these other activities? Well, I'm going to try to answer that question partly. Or let me give another question. What's the difference between preaching and delivering a lecture? I think this is most important. I think I've detected a tendency for people to imagine that giving a lecture is the same thing as preaching. That because you give a lecture from a pulpit, it becomes preaching. But it doesn't. I would draw a very great distinction here. I remember meeting some men during the war, chaplains in the United States Army, and I remember hearing one of them using an expression which rather alarmed me. He was in a certain part of England, and he'd been mixing in the churches and so on, and he'd come to a conclusion with respect to their condition. He said, "And then I decided to preach them my sermon on justification." And he told me all about himself as a preacher in saying that. You see, here's a man who had deliberately sat down to prepare a lecture on a sermon on justification, and he'd got another one on sanctification and on various other subjects. Here they are, my sermon on justification. To me, that man knew nothing at all about preaching. He'd got a lecture on justification. He had obviously prepared this address on justification, and then he'd found one of a number of texts which he could hook onto it. But that's not preaching. That's lecturing on justification and on these other subjects. Now, that is not preaching. There is a place for lecturing. Lecturing is essential. There must be teaching in the church. But all I'm concerned to say is that it isn't preaching. You may well come to the conclusion that I've got some odd notion as regards preaching, but I'm prepared to justify what I'm trying to say. And let me give you another negative. Some people seem to think that preaching consists of a running commentary on a passage of Scripture. Again, to me, that isn't preaching. I'm not saying that that hasn't its legitimate place and its function. You take a paragraph and you comment on every single verse. But that isn't preaching. That is, if you like, a Bible lecture that's a running commentary on a passage of Scripture. But still, to me, it isn't preaching. It passes as it very often, and especially in the Anglican Church in Great Britain. But to me, it's quite different from preaching. Or another way of putting that is this. A man may take a verse or a passage, and he may give you his exegesis, he may tell you about its context, and he may tell you the meaning of the words, he may divide it and open it out. But still, I say that is not preaching. Dare I use an example here to illustrate what I mean? I am the successor of a man called George Campbell Morgan, who was famous in your country as well as ours as a Bible lecturer. He called himself that, and it was a correct term. But many people thought he was a preacher. Now, Campbell Morgan was never a preacher, in my opinion. He was a Bible lecturer. What he did was he'd take generally a section, a paragraph of Scripture, or perhaps a whole chapter, very often a whole book, and he would analyze it for you and give it to you in its component parts. Some of you may have read some of his books. Now, that's all right as a sort of running commentary. He didn't produce commentaries as such, in a technical sense. What he did was to give you a general commentary, or a running commentary on a section or on a book in that way, and he would illustrate it here and there. But to me, it was never preaching, and he was quite honest about this. He used to give what was called officially a Bible lecture on Friday night at Westminster Chapel. Well, then he was announced to preach twice on Sunday, but he did the same in the three services. There was no difference. And he would defend this and say that, he said, I have been called to be a teacher. He was a teacher before his conversion. He says, I am still a teacher. I'm called to be a teacher. And I think that's interesting, and that is important, because his books were very popular, and I think he tended to have an influence in your continent and ours in the direction of making people imagine that that is preaching. Of course, the argument was, you see, it's more biblical. And sometimes when we were there together for 5 years sharing the ministry, and I believe people used to speak about us as the teacher and preacher. I was the preacher, he was the teacher. And some used to say that the one difference between us was that he was more biblical than I am. Now, I'm not here to defend myself, but I think that was a complete fallacy in this way. Doesn't matter who the two men might be. I maintain that his method never really got down to the message of the Scriptures. He dealt with the words. He gave this running commentary, but he never got down to the doctrine. If you were to ask me what Dr. Campbell Morgan's view of the atonement was, I simply cannot tell you. I don't know. He never dealt with doctrine. He wasn't interested in theology. He used to say so. And yet, you see, because he was all along dealing with the actual letter of the Scripture, he was thought to be more biblical. My idea of being biblical is that you bring out the real message, the treasure of the Scripture. You may not be so tied to the literal words all the time, but surely it is the meaning that matters ultimately. Not that I'm not interested in the other aspect, I am, but I say that Bible lecturing stops short of where I say true preaching begins. I would put the whole of that into my introduction, and still I haven't started preaching when they finish. However, these are some of the distinctions I'm trying to draw. Now, let me put it in another way. Do you draw a distinction between a sermon and preaching? For I do. And I have a feeling that part of the trouble with regard to preaching is that people do not recognize that distinction. Now, what is a sermon? Let's try and get at it like this. What's the difference between a sermon and a Bible lecture? or an exposition, exegesis of a passage. Well, as I see it is this, that a sermon is always a whole, it's an entity, it's a message. Take the word, the phrase that is used by the prophet in the Old Testament, the burden of the Lord. Now, this exposition of the scripture to me doesn't become a sermon until what you've been reading and what you have exegeted and explained in that way now takes the form of a particular message which leads to a particular end, what my friend and fellow lecturer was saying in the previous session about this purpose. A sermon has got form, therefore, and it must have form. It is a complete message, and it leads always to a particular end. Now, let me say a word like this in passing. I'm a great admirer of the Puritans, and have in a little way perhaps been responsible for a revived interest in them in Great Britain. But you know, the Puritans can be very dangerous from this standpoint of preaching. The Puritans were primarily teachers, in my opinion, not preachers. And so, you see, they would go and they would analyze their passage of scripture, then the time would have gone, and they'd say, well, we leave it at that for now, and then we take up next time. Now, by saying that, to me, they were saying they were not preaching. Because they haven't got this form, this wholeness, this complete message. I find it very difficult to put this into words. But this is, to me, a very vital point of distinction as between an exposition of a passage and a sermon. It's a process that goes on inside one's mind and heart and spirit. I don't know how it happens at all. But you see, it's the difference, it seems to me, between the cream that you put into that cask. I don't know how they make butter any longer, but I remember them making butter. You used to take the cream and you put it into a churn, and it went in just as cream, but then you turned the handle or you got a horse to work some great pulley, and this thing was churned and churned and churned. It came out as butter. Now, you haven't added to the ingredients at all, have you? But what comes out is different from what went in. It's no longer cream, it's butter. That's the nearest, I'm afraid, I can get to telling you the difference between exposition, exegesis, commentary and explanation of the meaning of words and so on, and a sermon. Same ingredients, different end result. I hope that helps you. It's the nearest I can get. Now, I must add a word of warning at this point, I think. I need it myself, I have no doubt very much. I don't know if you've read a book by a man called Hatch, Edwin Hatch, who was a dignitary in the Church of England in the last century. He delivered two lots of famous lectures. He delivered the Bampton Lectures, which is dealing with the nature and so on of the New Testament Church. And then, unless my memory fails me, about 1888, he delivered the Hibbert Lecture series, in which he dealt with the influence of Greek thought upon the Christian Church. I think that's more or less the title, but it's well worth reading. Now, Hatch, in that series of lectures, he makes a point which has troubled me considerably. In this way, he says that the whole notion of Christian preaching changed in the second century. And what he says is, this is his thesis, that the change took place as the result of Greek influence. You remember how in the second century the Christian church now came right up against the Greek world, and the apologists came in. They had to do this, of course. But according to the theory of Edwin Hatch, the Greek influence had a great effect upon Christian preaching, and the effect it had was this. He contends that the preaching of the apostles and of the early church was a kind of inspired prophetic utterance, but that owing to this apologetic influence that came in and the desire to present the gospel in a manner that at any rate would not be offensive to the cultivated Greek mind, that more and more they began to adopt the Greek and, in a sense, the Roman form of an address. Now, the form that had been employed by the great rhetoricians of Greece was a kind of a preliminary introduction of your matter, and then a division of your matter, and then a conclusion. And his contention in that book is that this became the form of the sermon from the second century onwards, as the result of this Greek influence. Now, I'm prepared to agree that what Hatch says is probably very true, but it puts me in a problem in this way, that I believe intensely in the what he calls the original idea of preaching. To me, that is the important thing, the most important thing of all. But I also feel that the form not only has a legitimate place, but is, in a sense, essential, if you are to convey the message truly to the people. But you see, we're always in this state of tension. How can I have form and yet avoid becoming a lecturer? How can I have this form, which I think the sermon must have, without allowing it to degenerate into some kind of general address? Well, with that caveat, I still make my assertion that we must always remember that the sermon must have this form and this end if it is truly to function. But now come to this other distinction. The difference between, or the distinction between, the sermon and preaching. And this brings me to the heart of the matter as I understand it. Do we draw this distinction? I have a feeling that it's because we've forgotten it that preaching has fallen on evil days. I remember hearing a story, and I say this simply to point my remarks. There was a preacher in Great Britain, Dr. J.D. Jones of Bournemouth. He used to come a lot to this country. And he was preaching in a place in Wales once, and a number of ministers met with him, and he was an old man by now. And they put a question that preachers are so fond of putting. They said, "Tell us, Dr. Jones, who's the greatest preacher you've ever heard?" And he thought for a while. Well, he said, "I don't know. Don't know. But I'll tell you this," he said. "The greatest preaching I've ever heard was the preaching of John Hutton." Now, I think that is a very good point. You see, what he was saying was this. He wasn't saying that Dr. John A. Hutton was one-time editor of our British Weekly. He wasn't saying that Dr. John Hutton was the greatest man he'd ever heard preaching. He wasn't saying that Dr. John A. Hutton's sermons were the greatest sermons that he'd ever heard. But what he was saying, and I know exactly what he meant because I heard Dr. Hutton, what he was saying was this, that Hutton's preaching was the greatest preaching that he had ever heard. Now, this man, Dr. Hutton, he was one of my predecessors at Westminster again, and extraordinary man he was, an extraordinary preacher. When I was a student, a young doctor at Inuit used to go and listen to him. I listened to him the whole time he was there. And I came to the conclusion that he really only preached really well about one out of every six occasions. What was the matter? Well, it was this. He was a man who didn't pay sufficient attention to the sermon. He'd got this preaching gift, and he tended to rely upon it. And it could be very bad at times. He'd ramble, and it was very difficult to follow him. There was no form about it. But when this sixth occasion came, you not only forgave him the other five, but you just went, hoping that it would happen again. I saw that man at the close of a sermon on one occasion. He was just finishing his sermon, and he somehow did this. And the whole congregation rose to its feet. I was amongst them. That's a tribute to his preaching. Now, what is this difference? Let me give you another illustration. I referred just now to Samuel Davies. Some of you will recall that I think it was about 1753. Samuel Davies and Gilbert Tennant were sent over from this country to Britain to collect funds for the Princeton College, which had been recently started about 1746, you remember. They were sent over to collect. And after a very long and tedious journey, they arrived in London. The first question, of course, they asked when they got there was this: is Mr. Whitfield in town? And to their great delight, they were told that he was, and that he was due to preach in the tabernacle the next morning, the Sunday morning. So, of course, they got there and got there early, and the place was crowded out. And eventually, Whitfield came in, and he preached. And Samuel Davis gives an account of this service, and it brings out this point to perfection. He said that he realized very quickly that Mr. Whitfield had obviously had an extremely busy week, for it was clear that he hadn't had time to prepare his sermon, that it was disjointed, illogical. Oftentimes, he was just rambling. There was no form there, but, he said, there was such unction upon the preaching, such an influence which he felt, that he gladly would have crossed the Atlantic again, and many times, in order to be under this tremendous influence. That's the difference, you see, between a sermon and preaching. That is why I think a man is in a very pathetic condition who says, I then decided to give them my sermon on justification. My sermon on this, that, or the other. What a terrible thing it is. I'm reminded by saying that of one thing which I didn't mention in my list of things that have done such harm to true preaching, and that is the publication of sermons. You laugh at this, but I mean this very seriously. I think that the printing of sermons in the last century has been one of the greatest harmful, painful influences upon preaching, and especially the sermons of Scottish preachers. Why? Well, I'll tell you. You see, these men were generally great literary men. And when they prepared their sermons, they were preparing them with a possible eye to publication. And to me, they've already gone fatally astray. If you prepare a sermon for publication, you're not going to be a good preacher when you preach that sermon. Your motive is wrong. Your concept is wrong. There is all the difference in the world between these two things. What is it? Well, now, I see my time is going, and it's such a tremendous subject. What is this point, then, about preaching? Well, it is this extraordinary position in which something is happening between the man who is speaking and the congregation that is listening. Now, you know the famous Phillips Brooks definition of preaching: truth mediated through personality. I think he's right, but whether he put the content into that I would put, I don't know. But there is a sense in which he really has put his finger on the essential thing. The whole man is involved in preaching. That's where there is this difference between the sermon and the preaching. It isn't merely what the man says, it is the way in which he says it. This total involvement of the man. His body is involved, every part of him, every faculty is involved, if it's true preaching. The whole personality of the individual. And at the same time, as I said, the congregation is also making its contribution. You are a spiritually minded people, and they've come prepared, and they are under the influence of the Spirit. And again, these two things become blended together, and the thing becomes a unity, and there is a transaction backwards and forwards. That, to me, is true preaching. And that is where you see the essential difference between listening to preaching in a church and listening to a sermon on the television or on the radio. You can't listen to true preaching in detachment. And you must never be in the position when you can turn it off. It spoils the whole thing. All right, well, I know that I'm speaking in a professional sense, am I not? And I understand your sympathy. What I'm trying to say is this, you see, that there is an element of control, there is an element of compassion in preaching. And those people are there, and they're gripped, and they're fixed. I maintain that if that isn't happening, you haven't got true preaching. That is why reading will never be a substitute. You can put the book down, or you can argue with it, you can do this and that. When there's true preaching, you can't do that. You're gripped, you're taken up, you're mastered. And I argue that this is an essential and a vital part of preaching. Well, very well, what are the things that hinder preaching? I'm sorry that I've got to rush now because my time is gone. Well, I feel that there are certain things that are a very great hindrance to preaching. One is professionalism. It's the curse of the work of the minister. Why do you preach on Sunday? Why will you preach next Sunday? Is it simply because you've been announced to do so? I've often gone into the pulpit for that reason, so have you. You've gone into the pulpit because you were announced to do so, because it's your job. All right, in a sense, that's right, but in another sense, it's very terrible. You do it merely because you've got to do it, and it's a part of your routine. That militates against true preaching. A man should always go into the pulpit with this sense of romance, this sense of this tremendous possibility. There should be an eagerness about it. Professionalism is a curse. Then another thing that militates against it is a man's over-reliance on his preparation. All I'm saying can be misunderstood, of course, seriously. The man who doesn't prepare is a fool. And yet the man who relies on his preparation is perhaps even a greater fool. He's written his sermon. He's prepared. He's got everything. Poor fellow. He's got nothing. But we do that, don't we? You know, when you're finished and you're ready for Sunday, simply because you've prepared the sermon. That isn't preaching. Then the danger, of course, of being led astray in the form of your preparation, this literary notion which I've already denounced, this idea to be literary or learned and to have masses of quotations and to this horrible phrase. I remember somebody writing about a preacher in England, and it was a lady journalist. She said, "He always shares his reading with us." That's abominable, utterly abominable. But let's come in, as you know. And we want to be considered learned, well-read men and so on. We had a man in Britain who was a popular kind of preacher, and he wrote a book, and this was the title, The Craft of Sermon Construction. I was asked by somebody what I thought of it. I said, to me, that's prostitution. The Craft of Sermon Construction. That's what the prostitute does. She decks herself up. She paints herself. She makes herself attractive in order to attract people. But you wouldn't marry somebody like that. No, no. We believe in love. And the attraction is not meretricious. The craft, it doesn't come in. There are certain elements which are bound to come in. But when you isolate this craft, and well, this man, you see, he was a great expert at these illustrations. But this is how he did it. He carried a little notebook in his pocket. Whenever he heard a good story, out came the book and he wrote it down. And he was always collecting. And then he went home. He said all this in the book, and he used to say it in lectures. He then classified them according to subjects. So, of course, then when you want to illustrate a particular point, you look up your particular section, and then you pull out the drawer, here are your stories, here are your illustrations. To me, that is just utterly reprehensible. I call that sheer prostitution. And preachers who read other people's sermons to get illustrations and stories are not fit to enter pulpits. Well, let every man examine himself. let me put it in another way. There was a bishop in Britain called Hensley Henson, ended as Bishop of Durham, and he wrote his autobiography. What did he call it? Reminiscences of an Unimportant Life or something. But the Unimportant Life takes two volumes. But this is what I remember reading in one of the two volumes. He was asked to preach a sermon on some great occasion, and he tells us in the autobiography how for 3 weeks he was preparing that sermon. To me, you see, that man knew nothing about preaching. He delivered a great oration, and he could do that, but it wasn't preaching. 3 weeks. Contrast that with Whitfield. Preaching here day after day, 5-6 times a day. No time, almost, for preparation, and yet what preaching? You see, this whole notion has gone astray. And then if a man reads a manuscript in the pulpit, it's destructive of true preaching. I even query the rightness of writing a sermon out in full and committing it to memory. I once used to do that. I stopped doing it because I felt that I was too mechanical. I was having to concentrate too much on remembering. That was a sort of recital. It wasn't true preaching. What I'm trying to say is this, you see, that there is an element in preaching which always leaves loose ends. There is something about preaching which you can't prepare. You prepare your son. But as regards preaching, you prepare yourself. That's the distinction. You prepare yourself for the preaching. You must have your sermon, but even when you've got it, if you haven't prepared yourself, and if this other element isn't there, it will avail you nothing. Let me come then finally to what I would call some of the vital elements in preaching. The first is our realization of what is happening, that we are sent of God, that we are heralds of this glorious good news, that we've got authority. And if we haven't got authority, we can't preach. We must have assurance. We must have absolute authority. Above all, we must be aware of our tremendous responsibility. The privilege of what we're doing, the responsibility of what we're doing. We are speaking from God to men. Now you know the story about Robert Murray McChain. This is the thing that humbles us, isn't it, and makes us feel we've no right to enter pulpits. It is said that when that man would even walk into his pulpit in Dundee, during the time of that revival, before he'd opened his mouth, people began to weep. Why? Well, there was something about his face. He'd come from God. He was already preaching before he opened his mouth. Man sent from God. And he's aware of this burden, and he's trembling because of the momentous consequences, the issues that depend upon what he does. Then, you see, this great idea of prophesying comes in. This word from God. Now, this brings us a little bit nearer still, perhaps, to this whole idea of preaching. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that a man has a revelation from God in the sense of some new truth. I'm not saying that. But to me, when a man is truly preaching, he has been given the message. Or what he may have himself acquired as the result of his study of the scripture and understanding of a passage and the ordering of it, this is taken up. And it becomes a prophetic utterance. He is speaking in the Spirit, in demonstration of the Spirit and of power. I think this is an absolutely vital element in true preaching. A man cannot preach in cold blood. It's impossible. He can utter a sermon. He can read an essay. He can recite an essay. He can give a Bible lecture. But you can't preach in cold blood. A man is taken up. He's in this realm of the Spirit. And God is giving a message through this man to the people. It isn't an inspired utterance in the sense that the scriptures are, but in another sense it is an inspired utterance because the Spirit is giving it and using it in that way. So a vital element in preaching is a reliance upon the Spirit. And another one is freedom. We must be free. That is why I say there are generally loose ends about preaching. A sermon which is perfect in its form, its diction, and in everything else, that militates against preaching. You know the Apostle Paul, you get it in his writings, he suddenly forgets, as it were, what he'd set out to say. He interrupts his own thought, he doesn't complete his own sentences, these anacoluthe, as they call them, and he never honors it. What is it? Well, this is the freedom of the Spirit. He's taken up, he mentions the name of the Lord, and off he goes to some great apostrophe. Then he may or may not come back to his argument. Now all of this, I say, is a very vital and essential part of preaching. It isn't only man preaching, as he says to the Thessalonians in 1 Thessalonians 2:13. You listened, he said, and you realized it wasn't merely the word of man, but it was indeed what it actually is, the word of God. This is his preaching. And this should be true of our preaching. So the preacher is a man who is possessed, and he's aware of this. I don't hesitate to make this assertion. I would say that I only begin to know something about preaching on those occasions when I, as it were, am looking on. I'm speaking, but I am really a spectator, and I'm amazed at what is happening. I'm listening. I'm looking on in utter astonishment. I'm not doing it. I know I often have to do all, and I do all in pulpits, but that isn't preaching. It's true preaching when I am conscious that I am being used. I am not doing it. I am listening, and I'm as much a spectator as the people who are listening to me. There is this consciousness of, it's outside me, and yet I'm involved in it. I'm merely the instrument and the vehicle and the channel of all this. And so one has this abandon, this freedom, and thoughts are given and expressions are given, ideas are given, the imagination is inspired and inflamed, and one is just aware that God is possessing one's whole personality and using every little faculty that he has ever given us at the beginning. Now that is as near as I can describe what is meant by preaching. And we are only aware of true preaching when we are aware in this way, that we can say, yet not I. I am preaching, yet not I. But I am being used of God. I am being taken up. I am being employed. And God is using even me to speak to these people. I am an ambassador for Christ. I am a sent one. I'm aware of this great responsibility. But it's all right. I am enabled to do it because of his grace and the power that he is gracious enough to give me. Well, brethren, I trust you will forgive these my rambling remarks. What can you do but something like this when you are given such a title? What is preaching? May God so send his Spirit upon us that we shall again really know what preaching is, experience it ourselves and hear others. That's the test, you see. Never tired of referring to that great occasion when Whitfield first preached at Northampton in Massachusetts for Jonathan Edwards. I think it's one of the most glorious things I've ever read of. There was this genius, Jonathan Edwards, listening to Whitfield, who wasn't in the same field, of course, from the standpoint of genius and ability and so on. But as he was listening to Whitfield, his face, says Whitfield, was shining. Edwards' face was shining, and tears were streaming down his face. Edwards was recognizing this authentic, authoritative note, this preaching. Whitfield was in the spirit, Edwards was in the spirit, and the two were blended together, and they were, the whole congregation and preacher were one in the hand of God. That's preaching. May God enable us to practice it and to experience it.